Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 16 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we take a wild trip through the 1987 John Hughes comedy Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Alan Sanders of The Wilder Ride and of many other projects. Welcome to the show, Alan.
How's it going?
Going great. Going great. Doing well.
Excellent.
Yeah, we're stuck in Wichita, but we're trying to figure out what to do.
I gotta say, it's wild because this is one of those movies we watch every Thanksgiving, getting ready for the Christmas movie watching season, the holiday watching season. But this is like the movie that kicks it off because it's one of the only, if not the only, holiday film that's basically dedicated to Thanksgiving. So it's wild. Here we are recording it in the beginning of a new year. And hey, the way it times out, maybe everybody will be able to go and listen to it all before this Thanksgiving.
You should be able to, because the whole show will be done by the beginning of July. So you'll have plenty of time to re-listen to the whole thing if you want to listen to it a second time. I don't know if you're going to want to go through that many hours. We'll have to wait and see how many hours it turns out to be. I mean, my Great Escape was, I think, over 60 hours worth of discussions. And most of those episodes were about 20 minutes, so, and that's 172 episodes. So you can do the math. It's a few days worth of just listening straightforward. So, all right, so minute 16 begins with Neil looking at Dell in a very strange way and ends with Doobie's taxi showing up at a motel.
Can I tell you, I am really... Just as a general side note, I am really bummed that this is the only pairing we have of Steve Martin and John Candy. These two guys are fantastic together.
I completely agree with you, but I also think that it's great that this is the only pairing that we have of them, because I think it might have, you know, it might have dampened things if they were in other movies together also. This is just so unique.
Right. And it's something we'll never know. We can discuss the pros and cons of it, but you're right. We'll never know. And because of that, we have a perfect pairing.
That is true. Definitely true. So the minute basically begins with Neil and Dell. As we were talking about on Friday, Neil and Dell are in the Wichita airport. They're trying to figure out what they're going to do. Dell offers to take Neil to a motel that a friend of his owns. And basically... Neil is debating what to do, and then he realizes that Dell has the steamer trunk, which caused all those problems, you know, back in New York, which we discussed 2 weeks ago. And when we were dealing with the script, I mean, there's a lot more of that steamer trunk in the script at the beginning in New York, which everyone probably has already heard the last few weeks when we discussed that. So basically, Neil at this point realizes that he has little choice but to go with Dell because he just doesn't want to stay in that airport.
Mm-mm. You know, one of the things you mentioned about more to do, and you've probably touched on it, but I just as a general comment about the script, I had no idea how long the original first cut of this movie was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Before
that's right.
Basically made it down.
That's right. It's almost a 4-hour cut. I mean, people were complaining about, you know, the fact that The Great Escape is long. This movie is I think an hour longer than that. The full edit, which we don't have.
Right,
but,
we don't.
But I do have a copy of the full of the I mean, they, but they apparently actually recorded everything. They filmed it all, but then they cut it all out.
Yeah, if you get a copy of the script, apparently John Hughes told Steve Martin, he goes, "Oh no, we're shooting everything. We're not cutting any of this."
And they did,
because when Steve Martin got the script, he's like, wait a minute, this is like a 4-hour opus. Yeah. And John Hughes is like, yep. He said, I wanted the audience to feel that by the time they got done with the movie, they were as exhausted as these two characters were by the time they made it through all of their adventures.
And apparently that works.
But I am glad they cut it down to make it move a little faster for us, the movie watcher.
I agree with you, because a lot of the scenes that they cut are pretty much extraneous. There's a few that are good ones, which we'll talk about through the course of this entire show. But on a whole, most of them rightfully were cut out.
Yeah.
Right. So we see Neil's look on his face that he realizes that he doesn't have much of a choice. And then we get a shot of a taxi driving in the middle of the night. Now, what do you know about cars? Are you a car person? I'm not. Are you a car person?
I'm not a huge car. I do know this is an old Bonneville. I have never in my life, even having grown up in Detroit, not Wichita, which is certainly not as motor city as Detroit, I've never seen a taxi tricked out like this. The massive the aerial on the back, the antenna that looks like it's for a ham radio more than a CB.
Yeah.
Just the decorations, the paint job. It's, I'm like, what? This must be this guy's. This is it. He's a cab company of one.
Yeah, basically. I mean, as you know, I also grew up in Detroit. So, yeah, I never saw anything like this either. So this is a 1968 Pontiac Bonneville. It's the version is a hard top sedan. So I looked it up to see how much it would cost to buy one today. I don't know how much it cost at the time. That I wasn't able to figure out. So if you want, there's on the website that I found it on, the thing is called Haggerty.com. So it says that there are four different levels of the conditions that you can get a car in. You can get the concourse, the excellent, the good, or the fair. How much would you think it would be? Just pick one of the four. Tell me how much you think it would cost to buy one of these today.
A classic car like this, 68, probably $30,000.
For which level? For the top
probably
level?
Probably for the not horrible, but probably a mid-level, something in decent drivable condition, something that doesn't need a lot of restoration.
Okay, well, again, according to this website, and I don't know anything about cars, so, you know, going based on what they say there, so the Concourse edition, which is top of the line, would go for today at $27,300. So you were close. You were very close on that one. And if you were to get it in excellent condition, it would be $19,400. Good condition is 12,200, and a fair condition is 10,100.
Well, it didn't hold its value as much as I thought. I figured with something a little bit older, because in the United States, anything more than 30 years is now considered classic territory. But right.
They talk about movies like that too. I don't like these that. Made. You know, people.
Yeah, I don't like that either.
people say, "Here, this classic movie from 1998." I'm like, "That's not classic."
Yeah, it is. If we're still watching it, yep.
Nah,
I don't like talking that way, but anyway.
Right. No, that's my point also. I don't like the phrase of that. Now, the first thing you notice is that this car does not have a license plate in the front. Okay. Here's another question for you. Of the 50 states, how many states require a front plate, or vice versa? You can say how many don't require a front plate. You know, we have front plates, back plates.
Right. I honestly don't know how many are left with that tradition. I know I grew up where we had it on the front and the back. And then when I moved to Georgia, it was front and back. And for the last probably 30 years, it's only been the rear plate. So I have no idea how many states still require a front and back.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'll give a little bit of history. In Kansas, which is where we are here, supposedly, even though we're not really in Kansas, we're not in Kansas anymore. In Kansas, they started having license plates in 1913. That was a requirement to start putting them on cars in 1913. In 1956, in Kansas, they changed the law that you only need to have a rear license plate because people complained that it actually messes things up if you don't have it, if you have to put one in the front. I'm not really sure what that means, but whatever. So of the 50 states, there are still 30 states that require 30 states plus Washington, D.C., that require a front plate along with it. So we were talking more than half.
I didn't realize it was that many.
Yeah, me neither. I was very surprised at that number.
That's shocking.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Because, I mean, you look at the way cars are designed today, so many of the front modern bumpers, they don't have a place to put a front tag.
Correct, which is one of the complaints that I saw. So basically, Kansas is one of those states that doesn't require it. I think Michigan also doesn't require it, correct?
Correct. I think they got rid of it around the 80s or maybe even before that. But because I know we used to have them on the cars when I was growing up. And then all I know is when the last time I was there, it was just on the rears.
Right. I think in the mid 80s, it was already changed when I was growing up there. Yeah, I'm a few years younger than you. Not that much.
Not by much.
Not by much. Not at all.
It's not the years, it's the mileage. Keep that.
That is true. That is definitely true. Thank you, Han Solo. Wait, so, is that Han Solo? No, Indiana Jones. Indiana Jones. Sorry. Jones. Sorry.
Same actor.
I got the actor. Character. There you go. So this taxi continues driving. Now, the first thing you notice is you can hear the music. Okay, there's a song playing that the lyrics that we can hear are, well, he takes you up and he beats you down, yeah. He plays around and he spends your money. Now, did you check to see where this is from?
I did not.
Okay, so the song is from a group known as Balaam and the Angel. Okay, and the name of the song is I'll Show You Something Special, and it was released in 1987, and it was released basically directly for this movie. And then they
no idea.
Yeah. Now, do you know what Balaam and the Angel is? Do you have any clue?
Nope.
It's a biblical reference. Balaam was a prophet of the Gentiles in the Old Testament, and he was hired by the king of Moab, Balak, to curse the children of Israel. And every time he tried to curse them, it didn't work. And then there's the whole story with him and the donkey, or the she-ass, you know, that wouldn't move forward because there was an angel in front of it. So that's where they get the name Balaam and the Angel. So I don't know how that's right. I tried figuring out why they named themselves that. I have no freaking clue. No clue whatsoever.
Yeah, no, that I could try to make something up right now, but I'll just go with I have no idea.
Right. I mean, they're a British rock band that put out a whole bunch of, I think they put out like four or five records in the late 80s, early 90s, something like that. So the taxi moves along, and we get a great shot of looking at everything on this taxi. The first thing you see, obviously, is the name on the side of the door, and it says Doobie's Taxiola. Which, as much as I tried, I couldn't find what that word means. It's not a real word from what I can tell.
Well, all I kept thinking when I saw Doobie is a reference to smoking a doob or smoking pot, or right. That, you know, that this was a pot smoking taxiola.
Yeah.
It's trying to sound really fancy. And you look at the scroll work that's painted on the doors, and then you see the lights that are along the running board and then that divide the door.
Yeah.
It's like, well, okay.
Yeah, seriously. And I mean, and then he has you can see the license plate, which says on it Wolf. And it's got a sticker from 1987. It says Kansas, 1987. I have no idea why he's called Wolf. It's never really referred to in the movie.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you that, because the very next cut, we see the license plate, and then in typical John Hughes, we cut to different things that help characterize who the person is. We go to his shifter, and there's a devil head.
That's right.
Why wouldn't the license plate be devil or something? It didn't seem like it made sense. Like, why would wolf on one and a devil's head on the other?
Yeah, absolutely no clue. They don't give us that much information here. Now, I've been trying to get in touch with Larry Hankin, and hopefully I'm going to be able to interview him. Maybe he'll have some insight into these things. Larry Hankin is the actor who plays Doobie.
Okay.
Yeah,
cool. I can tell you that the next shot I really did enjoy was this guy has no problem putting his female favorite poses and models up for everybody to see when they're riding in his taxi.
That is correct. Did you count how many there were? How many pinups?
I didn't count how many pinups. I was going to say probably a dozen.
Okay, I counted 14.
14, okay.
Yeah, so you're very close on the dozen there. And some of them have like playing cards. You know, you have a picture of a naked woman on there, and there's the six of clubs, and you see the six of spades and the ten of clubs on one of them. It's like playing cards that he basically has pasted onto I don't know if it's the roof or the side of the car for everyone to get a nice look at it. Absolutely no clue. And it is
funny.
Yeah, and there's like a scorpion tattoo print there. You know, the whole thing is I don't know. and there's also some of the pictures have like little balloon, like cartoon type sayings by them. So like one of them says, you call this a party. And another one says on it, wow.
All I kept thinking is, in our current era, our current climate, can you imagine younger generation getting in a taxi cab with this plastered all on the inside?
Nope, not at all.
I mean, you might as well just say lawsuit rolling down the road.
Yeah. basically. So they give us a quick shot of that, and you know, you could tell that Dell is even a little uncomfortable in this taxi, not just Neil. I mean, first you see Dell, and then he looks over at Neil, and he smiles at him in a very strange type of smile. You know, it's like he's not that comfortable here. And then we get a shot of Doobie, you know, Larry Hankin, as I mentioned earlier. You know, he's an actor who was born on the 7th of December, 1937. He's had 114 different TV credits, including he was on Seinfeld, and he was also on Friends. On Seinfeld, he played the character of Kramer on the pilot that they made. And on Friends, he played their neighbor downstairs, Mr. Oh, I can't remember his name right now, who actually dies. He bangs on the ceiling because they're making so much noise. And then they all stomp on the floor, and then they hear a big thud, and they see that he dies.
This would be perfect for my wife because she is a Friends trivia-holic. I think she's watched the entire Friends 10 seasons, start to finish, probably 10 times.
Oh wow! No, I saw it in the first run, and then I saw it once again the whole way through. You know, I do like watching TV shows the whole way through at some point because it gives you so much insight into the way that everything plays out throughout the course of all these seasons. When you don't have to wait, you know, throughout the summer to find out what's going to happen. You know, things like that.
Yeah.
He also has 58 movie credits. You know, he was in Yours, Mine, and Ours, which came out in 1968, which I always remember seeing him in that one. You'd like that too. You're also from a blended family. You should see that if you have never seen that, with Henry Fonda and Lucille Ball.
You know what? Now that you said Lucille Ball, I remember the name, but I don't think I've ever seen it.
Okay, there you got your homework.
Was it remade? Was it remade under a different name?
You know, it was remade under the same name with Dennis Quaid and Rene Russo, but it's not even close to being as good.
That's the one I think I saw.
Go see the original.
Okay.
As a kid growing up in a blended family, my parents had us watch it, and I've loved it ever since. And you know, now that I myself am part of a blended family, it's also great. I mean, it's about a widower with 10 kids who falls in love with a widow who has 8 kids.
Oh my god!
And they tried, and it's based on a true story.
Wow.
Yes.
Talk about Brady Bunch, but like on steroids.
Well, where do you think the idea of the Brady Bunch came from?
I guess it must have been from this.
Yes.
I never, like I said, having not seen the original, but yeah, obviously if that's the story that came first.
Yeah. So Alan, as I said, you got your homework cut out for you now.
All right.
And he's also been in 3 John Hughes movies. This one, he was in She's Having a Baby and Home Alone. All right. So we get a shot of him. He's got this like pompadour and he's got like a toothpick in his teeth. So, and he just like looks and winks at Neil, which I'm not really sure what that means.
Yeah, I was trying to figure that because I mean you're already feeling a little uncomfortable, and then the driver purposely goes over his shoulder, takes his eyes off the road for a good 5 or 6 seconds to give a slow wink, and then slowly turns his head back like, "Aren't you in for a good time?" I'm like, "Wait, what kind of movie is this?"
Yeah, he like really grins. He grins at him like a really huge grin. And at this point, Neil then says, "Where the hell is this motel?" And Del, he looks at Del asking this question, and Del turns around and then says to Doobie, "Doobie, is it much farther?" The answer is not much. And then what's interesting is at this point, Del then says to him, "Well, why did you take the interstate?" He said, "You said your friend had never been around here, so I just figured he'd like to look around."
In the middle of the night.
You don't see nothing on the interstate but interstate. I mean, he's obviously trying to just, you know, rack up the price. There's no question about that.
Right.
Now, I mean, I had this discussion a few weeks ago with one of the other guests about taxis. So if you take a taxi, do you always go with the meter, or do you try to haggle out a price beforehand so that they don't try to run up the meter?
Well, the thankful thing, the handful of times I've had to use a taxi have all been in New York, and I just go with whatever because I want to get in and out of that cab as fast as possible.
Okay.
I've had some horrible times in a taxi cab in the middle of summer with cabs that don't have air conditioning. The I mean, where the air conditioning is, roll your window down. I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me. So, yeah, I try to avoid taxis. I either will take I'll either drive or I'll do public transportation, but I don't like taxis.
Right. Now, what I wonder is, okay, Dell has been to this motel beforehand because he's going right. to a place that he knows. He also knows Doobie, apparently. I don't think that he just, you know, randomly found Doobie as a taxi driver. He must have called him. It sounds as if he knows him. So mm-hmm. shouldn't Dell know that they went around the scenic route?
You would think so. I was wondering that, unless maybe this is the first time they've gone this route, that maybe they're used to taking the interstate. Because right. when he gives them that answer, Dell kind of goes back to Neil and goes, well, you know, there you go. Well, kind of like, well, makes sense to me.
Well, especially since Dell realizes he's not paying. So what's the difference?
Right.
if Neil's paying, then I don't care. Now, did you notice that in the back and throughout the entire car, basically on the back windshield and the front windshield, there's like these strange little things dangling from the top? Did you notice those
things? Yeah, like tassels.
Yeah, they're tassels, but like, what's the purpose of those? You have any idea?
You know, I just had this whole idea that it's almost like a Cheech and Chong kind of Mexican flair, or sort of that you think that this makes your vehicle look really cool when you've got this old, you know, land boat that you're trying to dress up. So it just to me looked like something you would try to do if you were a drug runner, like, or a druggie, like a pot smoker, which again goes along with the name Doobie on the side.
Right.
So it reminded me of like Cheech and Chong.
True. And then Neil looks over at Dell and says, but it's the middle of the night. And Dell's answer is, I know. Meaning I'm not gonna cause any problems here.
I don't want to argue.
Exactly.
He's my buddy Doobie.
Again, it makes it, I mean, we see how optimistic Dell seems in this particular scene, even though, again, he's not paying.
Right.
It's much easier to be optimistic when you're not the one paying.
Depending where we are in the script, there's about halfway through this, we've got a shot coming through the windshield where you see the tassels along the top edge. You see the lights along the bottom edge of the windshield, and you're getting a shot across the dash, and you see, you know, Doobie's hands on the wheels. There's two round objects in front of the steering wheel. Are those supposed to be boobs?
I believe so. And it also has just like this white
right there.
Exactly. And he has this like white, it looks like feathers or something like that on the dashboard also. It's like covered in, I don't know if that's supposed to be carpeting or something like that.
It looks like it's hair or something. Like it's dog hair or something, just all put up on top. I don't know.
Yeah,
shag.
Yeah, and then you definitely have those two boobs just sitting there, right in front of the steering wheel. Don't know, no clue as to why that's there. It's
such a small detail. It goes by so fast that if you don't slow it down, because you really only catch it as the lights obviously they're making it look like they're driving down the street. And so you've either got the street light coming through the windshield and you just get a moment where it's lit up. Like you can't miss it.
Right.
And then it's in shadow again.
Right. And in the back, right on the other side of Doobie, you can see that there's like this skeleton. He has like this skeleton hanging there.
Which again, reminds me of like, again, a sort of south of the border, Mexicano flair, where in honor of the Day of the Dead, where you've got this skeleton hanging from your side window.
Exactly. So Dell's response to Neil as to why they're doing this is, but he's proud of his town. You know, that's damn rare these days. So again, Dell is trying to make it sound as if it's okay to be doing something like this.
Isn't it right off the bat? I mean, and I know we're only early on and the misadventures get worse and worse and worse as we go. So these are mild. These would be things like if this was your only adventure, you might not have a whole lot to tell about your story, but you get the sense already. Dell's a guy who's glass half full with everything, and Neil's the exact opposite. So it's always glass half empty.
Yeah, which is why they're perfect together. They're the complete opposites, which is great.
Very much a modern Odd Couple kind of story.
Yes. Yeah, and it also he has like these lights shining on the back windshield, which makes it look like it's maybe a scanner or something like a police scanner, because it's got like blue and red lights that keep flashing back and forth.
Well, the ones that I was looking at reminded me of having the old style equalizers in your car that would bounce with the power of the power meters.
Okay, so maybe that's what amplifier. It is. Okay.
Back in the 80s, because it seemed like it pulsated with the music, so it made you realize that not only is the music loud, he's probably got aftermarket stereo speakers, maybe maybe woofers in the trunk, you know?
Could be.
Because that 80s would have been that era of watching a lot of people trick out their cars as well. As we'll find out on the outside of the car later, it's not just a stereo ride, it is definitely something he's played with the suspension.
Dude. Yeah. No question about that. So basically the car then shows up in front of the Braidwood Inn, and we get to see the trunk doesn't even close because it has the steamer trunk hanging out the back.
Mm-hmm. Too big to close the trunk on that Bonneville, which is saying something about how big that trunk must be, because, I mean, a 68 Bonneville, I mean, you could put bodies in the back of that trunk. I mean, that's like your typical gangster kind of car of the day.
Apparently not steamer trunks that Dell walks around the whole country with.
Right.
As the car stops in front of the motel, the minute basically ends. So do you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script and a few other things?
No. One of the things I did notice and a rewatching, because, you know, whenever you watch a movie for just fun, you're watching it for fun. But when you're watching it for one of these exercises, you start paying a lot closer attention, which makes you wonder why you don't do that with movies anyway.
Yeah.
The number of side characters, little characters, probably day players that were only in one scene or were only there for one part of this story. It's just this script is littered with so many people. Like, this is all we're going to get in the cab, basically, over the next couple minutes of him getting out and unloading the trunk. And that's it. We're never going to, you know, that's, and there's so many of these little French scenes where it's just, it's like scene, 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 with all these little extras that are thrown in there to be like in the scene with the two main characters.
Yes. Yeah, it reminds me of like Quantum Leap, you know, where you have the same two characters throughout every single episode, and everyone else is just constantly changing.
Right, and you get these actors, and some of them are more known, and a lot of them I think are John Hughes favorites that you see along the course of the movie.
Yeah,
but they're willing to be in the scene for just one location, one scene, probably, like I said, 1 or 2 days of shooting, and then they're done.
Yeah, completely. All right, so the script has a few discrepancies here. One of them is when Neil asks Del, how far away is the motel? Del responds, oh, just up the road a piece. So it shows that Del doesn't really have any clue how far it is. And then we get a shot of the taxi meter, and it says that right now it's at $124.50.
Yeah, I'd say that cab driver took the scenic route.
Yeah, completely.
Hey, this makes me wonder. Maybe Dell doesn't know, because he's always figured out how to get somebody else to pay the bill.
That could be.
He's never paid attention.
That's true. What does he care? He's not paying, and he's never paid. You're right. Hey, I never thought about that one. Thanks for that that idea. So In the script, again, it's a minor discrepancy. It's a 1966 Bonneville, not a 68. And on the side of the car, it says Chariot of Sin, as opposed to Doobie's Taxiolo. No, which makes more sense with all of the various, you know, the pinups and all that stuff. It makes a little more sense that you would call it a Chariot of Sin.
Chariot of Sin. That's awesome.
And the description of Doobie is pretty funny also in the original script. It says, a hefty middle-aged greaser turns to reveal a tremendous glistening black wave of artificial hair, sideburns that would have shamed Elvis, a toothpick in his teeth.
Well, we got the toothpick.
Basically. Right.
So, it is amazing. I did hear that John Hughes, when he was so inspired to write this, and we're in the first 60 pages of the script, that he banged out 60 pages in like 6 hours. He was so inspired to write this story.
Yeah, we're on page 38. Kind of based on,
I'm sorry?
We're on page 38, the end of this minute.
So this was part of the very first sit down and just write. Like, he just banged out 60 pages in a 6 hour period. Yeah. And of course, it took him a few more days. I think the story is he wrote the entire script in 3 days.
Yeah, that's what I heard also.
That's nuts to me.
That's completely crazy.
But But it is based, I guess, somewhat on one of his really bad travel experiences back in the day when he was in sales or marketing or something and had a horrible flight that didn't go to where it was supposed to, and then it got canceled again.
It actually went to Wichita. Yeah, it heard it went to Wichita.
Because I knew it was someplace that he was supposed to be between New York and Chicago, kind of like this story, and then ended up someplace else. I didn't know where, but it was just interesting how he just kind of, you know, they always say write what you know, and he apparently had a very similar bad experience on trying to get home from a business trip.
Right, which also, the fact that this is one of his very few, I guess you could say, adult comedies, which works so well, says so much about the fact that he, you know, he knew how to write kids very well, and this movie shows that he could write real life experiences also in a very funny and poignant way.
You know, and the thing about him is he's a very good director, and he directed a lot of his stuff but he was so prolific. If you go look at his biography, obviously he's written probably twice the number of movies that he's directed just because he's written so many things. He couldn't direct them all.
Right.
It takes too long to make a movie. I can bang out a script in 3 days. Takes a lot longer than that to film a movie. So
correct.
I think he was one of my favorite directors growing up in the 80s, being exposed to a lot of the teen angst films, the growing up films, the coming of age films. And then I kind of grew up with John Hughes. So I'm glad you're doing this. I really am glad you're doing this flick.
Me too. What a surprise. What a coincidence. All right. So every Monday we have a special segment where we do what's known as Martin Monday, where my guest will give his top five Steve Martin performances. And at the end of this whole podcast, in the last few days, I will reveal which movie, what are the top five movies based on the rankings of every one of my guests. So why don't you tell me your top five Steve Martin movies?
All right, we will do the reverse countdown, if that's how you want it, going from five to number one as far as all-time favorite Steve Martin flicks.
Perfect.
For me, number five, Father of the Bride. Love that movie. Still to this day, thankfully, I have not yet been a father of the bride, but I've seen when I've been to weddings and I've seen the kind of craziness. And Steve Martin can do something that a lot of actors try to do. He can do wacky screwball like situation comedy and yet keep the human element to the point where there's humanity and feeling. Yeah. It's not just like where John Candy is sort of the goofball character. You sort of assume that all this crazy stuff would happen. You would think that Steve Martin would be the kind of character that keeps it all together. And so I've always liked him as an actor.
Yeah.
Number four. One of the first Steve Martin movies I ever saw in the theater when I was old enough to go to the movies by myself, All of Me.
Ooh, I love that movie.
That is still hysterical and for me still holds up. So funny. And Lily Tomlin as the spirit on the other side of the mirror.
Yes.
So good. If people listening, if they've never seen All of Me, one of his earlier films, check it out. I didn't know if it was had to be in our top five. I went with L.A. Story number three.
Okay, great.
It's not just a Steve Martin flick. It's an ensemble story of a bunch of actors, but L.A. Story is fantastic.
Yeah.
If you've never seen that.
I saw that in the theater when it came out. I remember just being blown away at how funny it was because it was just making so much fun of life in L.A.
It was good, but then they had some moments that just had you like – it's almost harrowing. Like you just realize it's really telling all the different facets of what it's like to be in LA.
Yeah.
Number two, this should be very familiar to you. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. His nut up scene that I wish I was part of that, where he drops the F-bomb, 18 times and is what gives it its R rating, is one of the funniest meltdowns I have ever seen on screen. I love it.
And that's apparently the reason why – that was one of the reasons why he agreed to be in this movie. I remember reading that the two scenes that sold him on this script is that scene, the F-bomb scene, and the scene where he's playing with the car seat, you know, with the reclining aspects of the car.
Awesome. My all-time favorite Steve Martin flick, number one, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Right.
I love him and Michael Caine two con men that in the middle of a con trying to con each other along the way and then end up being conned by other people. It is – it's so good.
It's a lot of fun.
So that is my all-time favorite.
All right. Excellent. So the other segment that we do every day is Off the Beaten Track, where either myself or my guest will tell a little adventure or misadventure of some story of something that happened to them. It could be long, could be short. So, Alan, why don't you tell us some adventure or misadventure that you've had over your life?
So for today, in honor of a scene that you had last week playing, and people want to know, I have an anti-fetish of feet. I don't like looking at toes. I don't like feet, especially male feet. And part of it is back in my earlier days with IBM when I was doing a lot of business travel, it was a Friday afternoon catching a flight, trying to get back home. I'm sitting there. I'm up against the window seat. So I've got the curved wall of the plane to my left. And I'm sitting there. And all of a sudden, I started getting this really horrid, funky smell coming up from the side of the seat. I'm going, did somebody look? And wedged between the wall coming right by my armrest, the dude behind me had taken his shoes off and had put his smelly feet basically right underneath my armrest. And I'm looking down at bare freaking feet, and I'm like, gonna hurl. I'm just like, what are you on a plane?
Whoa.
Especially after you've been working all day. So I literally can identify with the nastiness of who would do that. And I have been just horrified by bare feet, especially close to my face, ever since.
Wow.
So there you go.
Okay.
Not a fun trip. It goes along with this movie.
Yeah, for sure.
But it was a horrifying travel moment.
Yeah.
So, folks,
it wasn't Dell, was it?
Please. No, it wasn't Dell. But please, folks, if you're traveling, you're not in your living room. You're not at home. Okay? You're not at the hotel. Keep your shoes and socks on until you get to your destination. That's not appropriate for public.
And then okay? And then you take off your shoes and socks and you make fists with your toes.
Make fists with your toes, but that's back on the carpet. So many references.
Why not? That's what we do this, isn't it? Isn't that why we do this?
Well, it's what movie lovers do.
That's right.
I know that.
That's right. All right.
So there's my story for today.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. So, Alan, why don't you tell people how they can get in touch with you?
All right. So for a version of what we do here with Movies by Minutes, our first two seasons of The Wilder Ride were dedicated to two Gene Wilder movies. So you can find us, The Wilder Ride, where we did Young Frankenstein Season 1 and Blazing Saddles Season 2. Check that out. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I say us because my buddy Walt Murray is my co-host on that. And we had a lot of fun doing some talk shows as well to follow with our Seasons 3 and 4.
All right. Excellent. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher you might be using to listen to this show. And to find me, it's very simple. All you do is just do a search for a Movie Rob Minute. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. And you can find us on our website. So, Alan, you want to come back again tomorrow?
Absolutely. We got to figure out how to get this hotel. Are they even going to get a room?
All right. Well, until tomorrow, you're
fucked. You're fucked.